railing around the floor, and that left only the roof to be built. The roof was the difficult bit. One Saturday afternoon, when Timmy was in bed with flu, I decided to make a start on the roof all by myself. It was lovely being high up there in that conca tree, all alone with the pale young leaves coming out everywhere around me. It was like being in a big green cave. And the height made it extra exciting. My grandmother had told me that if I fell, I would break a leg. And every time I looked down, I got a tingle along my spine. I worked away, nailing the first plank on the roof. Then suddenly, out of the corner of my eye, I caught sight of a woman standing immediately below me. She was looking up at me and smiling in the most peculiar way. When most people smile, their lips go out sideways. This woman's lips went upwards and downwards, showing all her front teeth and gums. The gums were like raw meat. It is always a shock to discover that you are being watched when you think you are alone. And what was this strange woman doing in our garden, anyway? I noticed that she was wearing a small black hat, and she had black gloves on her hands, and the gloves came nearly up to her elbows. Gloves. She was wearing gloves. I froze all over.
"I have a present for you," she said, still staring at me, still smiling, still showing her teeth and gums.
I didn't answer.
"Come down out of that tree, little boy," she said, "and I shall give you the most exciting present you've ever had."
Her voice had a curious, rasping quality. It made a sort of metallic sound, as though her throat was full of drawing pins. Without taking her eyes from my face, she very slowly put one of those gloved hands into her purse and drew out a small green snake. She held it up for me to see.
"It's tame," she said.
The snake began to coil itself around her forearm. It was brilliant green.
"If you come down here, I shall give him to you," she said.
"Oh, Grandmama," I thought, "come and help me." Then I panicked. I dropped the hammer and shot up that enormous tree like a monkey. I didn't stop until I was as high as I could possibly go. And there I stayed, quivering with fear. I couldn't see the woman now. There were layers and layers of leaves between her and me. I stayed up there for hours, and I kept very still. It began to grow dark. At last, I heard my grandmother calling my name.
"I'm up here,"
I shouted back.
"Come down at once," she called out. "It's past your supper time."
"Grandmama," I shouted, "has our woman gone?"
"What woman?"
my grandmother called back.
"The woman in the black gloves."
There was silence from below. It was the silence of somebody who was too stunned to speak.
"Grandmama,"
I shouted again,
"has she gone?"
"Yes,"
my grandmother answered at last.
"She's gone. I'm here, my darling. I'll look after you. You can come down now."
I climbed down. I was trembling. My grandmother enfolded me in her arms.
"I've seen a witch," I said.
"Come inside," she said. "You'll be all right with me." She led me into the house and gave me a cup of hot cocoa with lots of sugar in it. "Tell me everything," she said. I told her. By the time I had finished, it was my grandmother who was trembling. Her face was ashy grey, and I saw her glance down at that hand of hers that didn't have a thumb.
"You know what this means," she said. "It means that there is one of them in our district. From now on, I'm not letting you walk alone to school."
"Do you think she could be after me, especially?" I asked.
"No," she said, "I doubt that. One child is as good as any other to those creatures."
It is hardly surprising that after that I became a very witch-conscious little boy. If I happened to be alone on the road and saw a woman approaching who was wearing gloves, I would quickly skip across to the other side. And as the weather remained pretty cold during the whole of that month, nearly everybody was wearing gloves. Curiously enough, though, I never saw the woman with the green snake again. That was my first witch, but it wasn't my last.
Summer holidays. The Easter holidays came and went, and the summer term began at school. My grandmother and I had already planned to take our summer holiday in Norway, and we talked about almost nothing else every evening. She had booked a cabin for each of us on the boat from Newcastle to Oslo at the earliest possible moment after my school broke up. And from Oslo, she was going to take me to a place she knew down on the south coast near Arendal, where she had spent her own summer holidays as a child, nearly 80 years ago. "All day long," she said, "my brother and I were out in the rowing boat. The whole coast is dotted with tiny islands, and there's nobody on them. We used to explore them and dive into the sea off the lovely, smooth granite rocks. And sometimes on the way out, we would drop the anchor and fish for cod and whiting. And if we caught anything, we would build a fire on the island and fry the fish in a pan for our lunch. There is no finer fish in the world than absolutely fresh cod."
"What did you use for bait, Grandmama, when you went fishing?"
"Mussels," she said. "Everyone uses mussels for bait in Norway, and if we didn't catch any fish, we would boil the mussels in a saucepan and eat those."
"Were they good?"
"Delicious," she said. "Cook them in seawater, and they are tender and salty."
"What else did you do, Grandmama?"
"We used to row out and wave to the shrimp boats on their way home, and they would stop and give us a handful of shrimps each. The shrimps were still warm from having been just cooked, and we would sit in the rowing boat peeling them and gobbling them up. The head was the best part."
"The head?"
I said. "You squeeze the head between your teeth and suck out the inside. It's marvellous." "You and I would do all those things this summer, my darling," she said.
"Grandmama," I said, "I can't wait. I simply can't wait to go."
"Nor can I," she said.
When there were only 3 weeks of the summer term left, an awful thing happened. My grandmother got pneumonia. She became very ill, and a trained nurse moved into the house to look after her. The doctor explained to me that pneumonia is not normally a dangerous illness nowadays because of penicillin. But when a person is more than 80 years old, as my grandmother was, then it is very dangerous indeed. He said he didn't even dare to move her to hospital in her condition, so she stayed in her bedroom, and I hung about outside the door while oxygen cylinders and all sorts of other frightening things were taken into her.
"Can I go in and see her?" I asked.
"No, dear," the nurse said, "not at the moment." A fat and jolly lady called Mrs. Spring, who used to come and clean our house every day, also moved in and slept in the house. Mrs. Spring looked after me and cooked my meals. I liked her very much, but she wasn't a patch on my grandmother for telling stories. One evening, about 10 days later, the doctor came downstairs and said to me, "You can go in and see her now, but only for a short time. She's been asking for you." I flew up the stairs and burst into my grandmother's room and threw myself into her arms.
"Hey there," the nurse said. "Be careful with her."
"Will you be all right now, Grandmama?" I asked.
"The worst is over," she said. "I'll soon be up again."
"Will she?" I said to the nurse.
"Oh, yes," the nurse answered, smiling. "She told us she simply had to get better, because she had to look after you."
I gave her another hug.
"They won't let me have a cigar," she said. "But you wait till they're gone."
"She's a tough old bird," the nurse said. "We'll have her up in another week." The nurse was right. Within a week, my grandmother was thumping around the house with her gold-topped cane and interfering with Mrs. Spring's cooking. "I thank you for all your help, Mrs. Spring," she said, "but you can go home now."
"Oh, no, I can't," Mrs. Spring said. "Doctor told me to see that you take it very easy for the next few days."
The doctor said more than that. He dropped a bombshell on my grandmother and me by telling us that on no account were we to risk the journey to Norway this summer.
"Rubbish!" my grandmother cried. "I've promised him we'll go."
"It's too far," the doctor said. "It would be very dangerous. But I'll tell you what you can do. You can take your grandson to a nice hotel on the south coast of England instead. The sea air is just what you need."
"Oh, no," I said.
"Do you want your grandmother to die?" the doctor asked me.
"Never," I said.
"Then don't let her go on a long journey this summer. She's not yet strong enough. And stop her smoking those vile black cigars." In the end, the doctor had his way about the holiday, but not about the cigars. Rooms were booked for us in a place called the Hotel Magnificent, in the famous seaside town of Bournemouth. Bournemouth, my grandmother told me, was full of old people, like herself. They retired there by the thousand because the air was so bracing and healthy it kept them, so they believed, alive for a few extra years.
"Does it?" I asked.
"Of course not," she said. "It's tommy rot. But just for once, I think we've got to obey the doctor." Soon after that, my grandmother and I took the train to Bournemouth and settled into the Hotel Magnificent. It was an enormous white building on the seafront, and it looked to me like a pretty boring place to spend a summer holiday in. I had my own separate bedroom, but there was a door connecting my room with my grandmother's room so that we could visit each other without going into the corridor. Just before we left for Bournemouth, my grandmother had given me, as consolation, a present of 2 white mice in a little cage, and of course I took them with me. They were terrific fun, those mice. I called them William and Mary, and in the hotel I set out right away teaching them to do tricks. The first trick I taught them was to creep up the sleeve of my jacket and come out by my neck. Then I taught them to climb up the back of my neck onto the top of my head. I did this by putting cake crumbs in my hair. On the very first morning after our arrival, the chambermaid was making my bed when one of my mice poked its head out from under the sheets. The maid let out a shriek that brought a dozen people running to see who was being murdered. I was reported to the manager. There followed an unpleasant scene in the manager's office with the manager, my grandmother, and me. The manager, whose name was Mr. Stringer, was a bristly man in a black tailcoat.
"I cannot permit mice in my hotel, madam,"
he said to my grandmother.
How dare you say that when your rotten hotel is full of rats anyway?
My grandmother cried.
Rats!
Cried Mr. Stringer, going mauve in the face.
There are no rats in this hotel.
I saw one this very morning,
my grandmother said.
It was running down the corridor into the kitchen.
That is not true, cried Mr. Stringer. You had better get the rat catcher in at once, my grandmother said, before I report you to the public health authorities. I expect there's rats scuttling all over the kitchen floor and stealing the food off the shelves and jumping in and out of the soup.
Never, cried Mr. Stringer.
No wonder my breakfast toast was all nibbled round the edges this morning,
my grandmother went on relentlessly. No wonder it had a nasty, ratty taste.
If you're not careful, the health people will be ordering the entire hotel to be closed before everyone gets typhoid fever.
You are not being serious, madam, Mr. Stringer said.
I was never more serious in my life, my grandmother said. Are you or are you not going to allow my grandson to keep his white mice in his room?
The manager knew when he was beaten. May I suggest a compromise, madam? He said. I will permit him to keep them in his room as long as they are never allowed out of the cage. How's that?
That would suit us very well, my grandmother said. And she stood up and marched out of the room with me behind her.
There is no way you can train mice inside a cage.
Yet I dared not let them out because the chambermaid was spying on me all the time. She had a key to my door and she kept bursting in at all hours, trying to catch me with the mice out of the cage. She told me that the first mouse to break the rules would be drowned in a bucket of water by the hall porter. I decided to seek a safer place where I could carry on with the training. There must surely be an empty room in this enormous hotel. I put one mouse into each trouser pocket and wandered downstairs in search of a secret spot. The ground floor of the hotel was a maze of public rooms, all of them named in gold letters on the doors. I wandered through the lounge and the smoking room and the card room and the reading room and the drawing room. None of them was empty. I went down a long, wide corridor, and at the end of it I came to the ballroom. There were double doors leading into it, and in front of the doors there was a large notice board on a stand. The notice on the board said, RSPCC meeting, strictly private. This room is reserved for the annual meeting of the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children. The double doors into the room were open. I peeped in. It was a colossal room. There were rows and rows of chairs, all facing a platform. The chairs were painted gold, and they had little red cushions on the seats. But there was not a soul in sight. I sidled cautiously into the room. What a lovely, secret, silent place it was. The meeting of the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children must have taken place earlier in the day, and now they had all gone home. Even if they hadn't, even if they did suddenly come pouring in, they would be wonderful, kind people who would look with favour upon a young mouse trainer going about his business. At the back of the room, there was a large folding screen with Chinese dragons painted on it. I decided, just to be on the safe side, to go behind the screen and do my training there. I wasn't a bit frightened of the Prevention of Cruelty to Children people, but there was always a chance that Mr. Stringer, the manager, might pop his head round the door. If he did, and if he saw the mice, the poor things would be in the hall porter's bucket of water before I could shout stop. I tiptoed to the back of the room and settled myself on the thick green carpet behind the big screen.
splendid place this was. Ideal for mouse training.
I took William and Mary out of my trouser pockets. They sat beside me on the carpet, quiet and well-behaved. The trick I was going to teach them today was tightrope walking. It is not all that difficult to train an intelligent mouse to be an expert tightrope walker, provided you know exactly how to go about it. First, you must have a piece of string. I had that. Then, you must have some good cake. A fine currant cake is the favourite food of white mice. They are dotty about it. I had brought with me a rock cake which I had pocketed while having tea with Grandmama the day before. Now, here's what you do. You stretch the string tight between your two hands, but you start by keeping it very short, only about 3 inches. You put the mouse on your right hand and a little piece of cake on your left hand. The mouse is therefore only 3 inches away from the cake. He can see it and he can smell it. His whiskers twitch with excitement. He can almost reach the cake by leaning forward, but not quite. He only has to take 2 steps along the string to reach this tasty morsel. He ventures forward, one paw on the string, then the other. If the mouse has a good sense of balance, and most of them have, he will get across easily. I started with William. He walked the string without a moment's hesitation. I let him have a quick nibble of the cake, just to whet his appetite. Then I put him back on my right hand. This time I lengthened the string. I made it about 6 inches long. William knew what to do now. With superb balance, he walked step by step along the string until he reached the cake. He was rewarded with another nibble. Quite soon, William was walking a 24-inch tightrope, or rather tight string, from one hand to the other to reach the cake. It was wonderful to watch him. He was enjoying himself tremendously. I was careful to hold the string near the carpet, so that if he did lose his balance, he wouldn't have far to fall. But he never fell. William was obviously a natural acrobat, a great tightrope-walking mouse. Now it was Mary's turn. I put William on the carpet beside me and rewarded him with some extra crumbs and a currant. Then I started going through the same routine all over again with Mary. My blinding ambition, you see, my dream of dreams, was to become one day the owner of a white mouse circus. I would have a small stage with red curtains in front of it, and when the curtains were drawn apart, the audience would see my world-famous performing mice walking on tight ropes, swinging from trapezes, turning somersaults in the air, bouncing on trampolines, and all the rest of it. I would have white mice riding on white rats, and the rats would gallop furiously round and round the stage. I was beginning to picture myself travelling first class all over the globe with my famous white mouse circus and performing before all the crowned heads of Europe. I was about halfway through Mary's training when suddenly I heard voices outside the ballroom door. The sound grew louder. It swelled into a great babble of speech from many throats. I recognised the voice of the awful hotel manager, Mr. Stringer. Help, I thought. But thank heavens for the huge screen. I crouched behind it and peered through the crack between 2 of the folding sections. I could see the entire length and width of the ballroom without anyone seeing me.
"Well, ladies, I am sure you will be quite comfortable in here," Mr. Stringer's voice was saying. Then in through the double doors he marched, black tailcoat and all, spreading his arms wide as he ushered in a great flock of ladies. "If there's anything we can do for you, do not hesitate to let me know," he went on, Tea will be served for all of you on the Sunshine Terrace after you've concluded your meeting.
With that, he bowed and scraped himself out of the room as a vast herd of ladies from the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children came streaming in. They wore pretty clothes, and all of them had hats on their heads.
The meeting. Now that the manager had gone, I was not particularly alarmed. What better than to be imprisoned in a room full of these splendid ladies? If I ever got talking to them, I might even suggest that they come and do a bit of cruelty to children preventing at my school. We could certainly use them there. In they came, talking their heads off. They began milling around and choosing their seats, and there was a whole lot of stuff like, "Come and sit next to me, Millie dear." "Oh, hello, Beatrice. Haven't seen you since the last meeting. What an adorable dress you have on." I decided to stay where I was and let them get on with their meeting while I got on with my mouse training. But I watched them for a while longer through the crack in the screen, waiting for them to settle down. How many were there? I guessed about 200. The back rows filled up first. They all seemed to want to sit as far back from the platform as possible. There was a lady wearing a tiny green hat in the middle of the back row who kept scratching the nape of her neck. She couldn't leave it alone. It fascinated me the way her fingers kept scratching away at the hair on the back of her neck. Had she known somebody was watching her from behind, I'm sure she would have been embarrassed. I wonder if she had dandruff. All of a sudden, I noticed that the lady next to her was doing the same thing. And the next one. And the next. The whole lot of them were doing it. They were all scratching away like mad at the hair on the backs of their necks. Did they have fleas in their hair? More likely it was nits. A boy at school called Ashton had had nits in his hair last term, and the matron had made him dip his whole head in turpentine. It killed the nits all right, but it nearly killed Ashton as well. Half the skin came away from his scalp. I began to be fascinated by these hair-scratching ladies. It is always funny when you catch someone doing something coarse and she thinks no one is looking. Nose-picking, for example, or scratching her bottom. Hair-scratching is very nearly as unattractive, especially if it goes on and on. I decided it had to be nits. Then the most astonishing thing happened. I saw one lady pushing her fingers up underneath the hair on her head, and the hair, the entire head of hair, lifted upwards all in one piece. And the hand slid underneath the hair and went on scratching. She was wearing a wig. She was also wearing gloves. I glanced swiftly around at the rest of the now-seated audience. Every one of them was wearing gloves. My blood turned to ice. I began to shake all over. I glanced frantically behind me for a back door to escape through. There wasn't one. Should I leap out from behind the screen and make a dash for the double doors? Those double doors were already closed, and I could see a woman standing in front of them. She was bending forward and fixing some sort of a metal chain round the two door handles. "Keep still," I told myself. "No one has seen you yet. There's no reason in the world why they should come and look behind the screen." But one false move, one cough, one sneeze, one nose blow, one little sound of any sort, and it won't be just one witch that gets you. It'll be 200! At that point, I think I fainted. The whole thing was altogether too much for a small boy to cope with. But I don't believe I was out for more than a few seconds. And when I came to, I was lying on the carpet, and I was still, thank heavens, behind the screen. There was absolute silence all around me. Rather shakily, I got to my knees and peered once again
through the crack in the screen. Frizzled like a fritter. All the women, or rather the witches, were now sitting motionless in their chairs and staring as though hypnotized at somebody who had suddenly appeared on the platform. That somebody was another woman. The first thing I noticed about this woman was her size. She was tiny, probably no more than 4.5 feet tall. She looked quite young, I guessed about 25 or 26, and she was very pretty. She had on a rather stylish, long black dress that reached right to the ground, and she wore black gloves that came up to her elbows. Unlike the others, she wasn't wearing a hat. She didn't look to me like a witch at all, but she couldn't possibly not be one, otherwise what on earth was she doing up there on the platform? And why, for heaven's sake, were all the other witches gazing at her with such a mixture of adoration, awe, and fear? Very slowly, the young lady on the platform raised her hands to her face. I saw her gloved fingers unhooking something behind her ears, and then she caught hold of her cheeks and lifted her face clean away. The whole of that pretty face came away in her hands. It was a mask. As she took off the mask, she turned sideways and placed it carefully upon a small table nearby. And when she turned round again and faced us, I very nearly screamed out loud. That face of hers was the most frightful and frightening thing I have ever seen. Just looking at it gave me the shakes all over. It was so crumpled and wizened, so shrunken and shriveled, it looked as though it had been pickled in vinegar. It was a fearsome and ghastly sight. There was something terribly wrong with it, something foul and putrid and decayed. It seemed quite literally to be rotting away at the edges. And in the middle of the face, around the mouth and cheeks, I could see the skin all cankered and worm-eaten, as though maggots were working away in there. There are times when something is so frightful you become mesmerized by it and can't look away. I was like that now. I was transfixed. I was numbed. I was magnetized by the sheer horror of this woman's features. But there was more to it than that. There was a look of serpents in those eyes of hers as they flashed around the audience. I knew immediately, of course, that this was none other than the Grand High Witch herself. I knew also why she had worn a mask. She could never have moved around in public, let alone book in at a hotel, with her real face. Everyone who saw her would have run away screaming. "The doors!" shouted the Grand High Witch in a voice that filled the room and bounced around the walls. "Are they chained and bolted?"
"The doors are chained and bolted, Your Grandness," answered a voice in the audience.
The brilliant snake's eyes that were set so deep in that dreadful, rotting, worm-eaten face glared unblinkingly at the witches who sat facing her.
"You may remove your gloves," she shouted.
Her voice, I noticed, had that same hard, metallic quality as the voice of the witch I had met under the conker tree, only it was far louder and much, much harsher. It rasped, it grated, it snarled, it scraped, it shrieked, and it growled. Everyone in the room was peeling off her gloves. I was watching the hands of those in the back row. I wanted very much to see what their fingers looked like and whether my grandmother had been right. Ah, yes. I could see several of them now. I could see the brown claws curving over the tips of the fingers. They were about 2 inches long, those claws, and sharp at the ends.
You may himself, your souls,
barked the Grand High Witch. I heard a sigh of relief going up from all the witches in the room as they kicked off their narrow, high-heeled shoes. Then I got a glimpse under the chairs of several pairs of stockinged feet, square and completely toeless. Revolting they were, as though the toes had been sliced away from the feet with a carving knife.
You may remove your figs,
snarled the Grand High Witch. She had a peculiar way of speaking. There was some sort of a foreign accent there, something harsh and guttural, and she seemed to have trouble pronouncing the letter W. As well as that, she did something funny with the letter R. She would roll it round and round her mouth like a piece of hot pork crackling before spitting it out.
Remove your vicks and get some fresh air into your spotty scalps,
she shouted. And another sigh of relief arose from the audience as all the hands went up to the heads and all the wigs, with the hats still on them, were lifted away. There now appeared in front of me row upon row of bald female heads, a sea of naked scalps, every one of them red and itchy-looking from being rubbed by the linings of the wigs. I simply cannot tell you how awful they were. And somehow the whole sight was made more grotesque, because underneath those frightful scabby bald heads, the bodies were dressed in fashionable and rather pretty clothes. It was monstrous. It was unnatural. Oh, heavens, I thought. Oh, help. Oh, Lord, have mercy on me. These foul, bald-headed females are child-killers, every one of them, and here I am imprisoned in the same room and I can't escape. At that point, a new and doubly horrifying thought struck me. My grandmother had said that with their special nose holes, they could smell out a child on a pitch-black night from right across the other side of the road. Up to now, my grandmother had been right every time. It seemed a certainty, therefore, that one of the witches in the back row was going to sniff me out at any moment, and then the yell of, "Dog's droppings!" would go up all over the room and I would be cornered like a rat. I knelt on the carpet behind the screen, hardly daring to breathe. Then suddenly I remembered another very important thing my grandmother had told me. The dirtier you are, she had said, the harder it is for a witch to smell you out. How long since I had last had a bath? Not for ages. I had my own room in the hotel, and my grandmother never bothered with silly things like that. Come to think of it, I don't believe I'd had a bath since we arrived. When had I last washed my hands or face? Certainly not this morning. Not yesterday, either. I glanced down at my hands. They were covered with smudge and mud and goodness knows what else besides. So, perhaps I had a chance after all. The stink waves couldn't possibly get out through all that dirt.
Witches of England,
shouted the Grand High Witch. She herself, I noticed, had not taken off either her wig or her gloves or her shoes.
Witches of England, she yelled.
The audience stirred uneasily and sat up straighter in their chairs.
Miserable witches! She yelled. Useless, lazy witches! Feeble, feebling witches! You are a heap of idle, good-for-nothing worms!
A shudder went through the audience.
The Grand High Witch was clearly in an ugly mood, and they knew it.
I had a feeling that something awful was going to happen soon.
I am having my breakfast this morning, cried the Grand High Witch. And I am looking out of the window at the beach. And what am I seeing? I am asking you, what am I seeing? I am seeing a revolting sight. I am seeing hundreds. I am seeing thousands of rotten, repulsive little children playing on the sand. It is putting me right off my food!
I have not got rid of them!
She screamed.
Why have you not rubbed them all out, these filthy, smelly children?
With each word she spoke, flecks of pale blue phlegm shot from her mouth like little bullets.
I am asking you why! She screamed.
Nobody answered her question.
Children smell! She screamed. They stink out the world! We do not want these children around here!
The bald heads in the audience all nodded vigorously.
One child a week is no good to me, the Grand High Witch cried out.
Is that the best you can do?
We will do better, murmured the audience. We will do much better.
Better is no good either,
shrieked the Grand High Witch.
I demand maximum results! So here are my orders. My orders are that every single child in this country shall be rubbed out, squashed, squatted, squitted, and fretted before I come here again in 1 year's time. Do I make myself clear?
A great gasp went up from the audience. I saw the witches all looking at one another with deeply troubled expressions. And I heard one witch at the end of the front row saying aloud,
All of them! We can't possibly wipe out all of them!
The Grand High Witch whipped round as though someone had stuck a skewer into her bottom.
Who said that? She snapped. Who dares to argue with me? It was you, was it not?
She pointed a gloved finger, as sharp as a needle, at the witch who had spoken.
I didn't mean it, your grandness, the witch cried out. I didn't mean to argue, I was just talking to myself.
You dared to argue with me?
Screamed the Grand High Witch.
I was just talking to myself, cried the wretched witch. I swear it, your grandness.
She began to shake with fear. The Grand High Witch took a quick step forward, and when she spoke again, it was in a voice that made my blood run cold.
A stupid witch who answers back must burn until her bones are black,
she screamed.
No! No!
Begged the witch in the front row. The Grand High Witch went on.
A foolish witch without a brain must sizzle in the fiery flame!
Save me!
Cried the wretched witch in the front row. The Grand High Witch took no notice of her. She spoke again.
An idiotic witch like you must throw stuff on the barbecue!
Forgive me, oh, your grandness!
Cried the miserable culprit.
I didn't mean it!
But the Grand High Witch continued with her terrible recital.
A witch who dares to say I'm wrong will not be with us very long!
A moment later, a stream of sparks that looked like tiny white-hot metal filings came shooting out of the Grand High Witch's eyes and flew straight towards the one who had dared to speak. I saw the sparks striking against her and burrowing into her, and she screamed a horrible howling scream, and a puff of smoke rose up around her. The smell of burning meat filled the room. Nobody moved. Like me, they were all watching the smoke. And when it had cleared away, the chair was empty. I caught a glimpse of something wispy white, like a little cloud, fluttering upwards and disappearing out of the window. A great sigh rose up from the audience. The Grand High Witch glared around the room.
I hope nobody else is going to make me cross today, she remarked.
There was a deathly silence.
Frizzled like a fritter, said the Grand High Witch. Cooked like a carrot. You will never see her again. Now we can get down to business.
Formula 86, Delayed Action Mouse Maker.
Children are revolting, screamed the Grand High Witch. We will wipe them all away. We will scrub them off the face of the earth. We will flush them down the drain.
Yes, yes, chanted the audience. Wipe them away. Scrub them off the earth. Flush them down the drain.
Children are foul and filthy, thundered the Grand High Witch.
They are, chorused the English witches. They are foul and filthy.
Children are dirty and stinky, screamed the Grand High Witch.
Dirty and stinky, cried the audience, getting more and more worked up.
Children are smelling of dogs dripping, screeched the Grand High Witch.
Poo, cried the audience. Poo, poo, poo.
They are worse than dogs droppings, screeched the Grand High Witch. Dogs droppings is smelling like violets and primroses compared with children.
Violets and primroses, chanted the audience. They were clapping and cheering almost every word spoken from the platform. The speaker seemed to have them completely under her spell.
To talk about children is making me sick, screamed the Grand High Witch. I am feeling sick even thinking about them. Fetch me a basin.
The Grand High Witch paused and glared at the mass of eager faces in the audience. They waited, wanting more.
So now, barked the Grand High Witch, so now, I am having a plan. I am having a giganticus plan for getting rid of every single child in the whole of Inkland.
The witches gasped. They gaped. They turned and gave each other ghoulish grins of excitement.
Yes, thundered the Grand High Witch. They will swish them and swallop them, and we shall make to disappear every single smelly little brat in England in one stroke.
Whoopee! Cried the witches, clapping their hands. You are brilliant, oh, your grandness. You are fantabulous.
Shut up and listen, snapped the Grand High Witch. Listen very carefully and let us not be having any muck-ups.
The audience leaned forward, eager to learn how this magic was going to be performed.
Each and every one of you, thundered the Grand High Witch, is to go back to your hometowns immediately and resign from your jobs. Resign. Give notice. Retire.
We will, they cried. We will resign from our jobs.
And after you have resigned from your jobs, the Grand High Witch went on, each and every one of you will be going out, and you will be buying...
She paused.
What will we be buying? They cried. Tell us, oh brilliant one, what is it we shall be buying?
Seven ships!
Shouted the Grand High Witch.
Sweet shops, they cried. We are going to buy sweet shops. What a frumptious wheeze.
Each of you will be buying for herself a sweet shop. You will be buying the very best and most respectable sweet shops in Inkland.
We will, they answered. Their dreadful voices were like a chorus of dentists' drills, all grinding away together.
I am wanting no tuppenny halfpenny crummy little tobacco-selling newspaper sweet shops,
shouted the Grand High Witch.
I am wanting you to get only the very best sweet shops, filled up high with piles and piles of luscious sweets and tasty chocks. The best, they cried. They shall buy the best sweet shops in town.
You will be having no trouble in getting what you want, shouted the Grand High Witch, because you will be offering four times as much as the shop is worth. And nobody is refusing an offer like that. Money is not a problem to us witches, as you know very well. I have brought with me 6 tanks stuffed full of English banknotes, all new and crisp.